Before we start the presentations in this next general session, Joanne and I have the great pleasure of making the 2011 NATOA Ovation Awards. These awards traditionally go out to individuals who have really gone above and beyond and have demonstrated their really outstanding commitment both to our organization and to the issues that we represent. We're just going to tell you briefly about what some of these folks did. Two of the awardees are not here. Jeff Arnold from NACO has been a tremendous partner to NATOA. We were fortunate when we brought Steve Traylor in as our executive director that he and Jeff had had an immediate prior, very positive working relationship when they were both at NACO, and Jeff has continued to bring his organization to the table and partner with us on a wide variety of issues, and our Ovation Award is to recognize him for that very, very successful partnership that he has demonstrated over the past year. We also have an award for Lainey Williams, who, as many of you know, is one of our attorney members. She has volunteered her time and has reached out to the hundreds, literally hundreds, of local governments who were named as bad actors in the Rights of Way NOI by industry commenters, but were not sent copies of those pleadings, so they would not have known unless they happened to just read the FCC website as part of their daily fun, that they had been identified as bad actors. And Lainey has taken it upon herself to contact almost all of those communities and talk about how they were named in a negative way. And we've discovered, amazingly, that some of the things that were said weren't true.
Some of the communities didn't exist.
So, there was even one community that didn't exist. The PCIA criticized a county in Maryland that does not exist. So, moving on to those members who are here, I am privileged to present an award to someone who is being recognized because of a lot of reasons, but primarily this organization is thriving today because we have members who not only recognize the benefit of it, but talk to their colleagues about it and constantly promote what NATOA brings as far as value to the local government community. And nobody does that better in this organization and has done it better, especially over the last year or so as we have pulled out of the financial troubles that we had a few years ago and have started back on a positive growth mode than Pam Berrien. So, Pam, we have an Ovation Award for you. And I'm really excited that Pam is one of our new board members as well.
Wow, I'm surprised and honored. Thank you.
Thank you. Right. As many of you know, we have worked very actively this year on getting the CAP Act reintroduced, this time with bipartisan support, and hopefully it will begin to start making some progress. In order to do that, we had to work with lots of people to get the language right. And we have an Ovation Award for someone who donated a significant amount of his time to help us on that legislative drafting, and because of that, we have a really good bill, and hopefully it will continue to move forward, and I would like to recognize Brian Grogan.
And I get to recognize someone who has brought extraordinary things to NATOA and has given so much in the past year, both in resources and support and help, and also in just unbelievable amounts of energy, so much energy that she tires us out. So an Ovation Award with thanks to Mitzi Herrera.
She wants a photo.
I work in TV.
Thank you.
For extraordinary leadership in conceiving, convening, organizing, facilitating, and providing great leadership to a new forum within NATOA that we call the Renewal Forum that has brought NATOA members together to work together, to think together, plan, strategize, and compare notes for creating and then facilitating the Renewal Forum, an Ovation Award for Cor Wilson.
All right, well, we have a slight change in the way this next session is going to go, demonstrating our ability to be agile and change with the times. One of our planned speakers for the panel, Joaquin Alvarado, had an emergency, needed to leave to go to the other coast yesterday. So rather than have a discussion, we actually have two really good speakers that are going to talk about slightly different topics, and I'm going to introduce them one by one. In order not to confuse anyone. The first speaker that we have is Brewster Kahle, and he is known now as an internet pioneer and the founder of the Internet Archive, a digital librarian. But I'm not going to go into the details of his background because he has some really exciting, interesting, intriguing opportunities for us, and he is looking for partners. So I'm going to let Brewster come up and start, and then he'll take questions after his presentation, and then we'll have our second general session speaker, Brewster Kahle.
Thank you. Let's see. Well, this is a great time to be building a gigabit community network. The technology has really come around a corner. It's robust and inexpensive. The expectation is that the internet is everywhere, but it isn't. And we're looking to expand a mechanism of getting this out to a couple more cities. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So who are we? So I work with the organization called the Internet Archive. It's a nonprofit library headquartered in San Francisco, employs 150 people. These people are mostly in scanning centers all over the world, six countries and 27 libraries, digitizing books and microfilm and the like to build up a large collection. The idea is that we have the opportunity to have universal access to all knowledge. The idea of everything ever published, all books, music, video, web pages, software, can be available to anybody anywhere that's curious enough to want to have access to it. So we're founded on that, of helping that idea move forward. And we mostly work with the library community to be able to get to a lot of these things, but we also work with the internet community, the Wikipedias, Mozillas, and the like. To basically build this. We're an independent nonprofit. We're not part of the government nor a university, but we get help and work with organizations all over. To give sort of an idea, we host for free lots and lots and lots of movies that people can download and reuse and make use of, and they upload them from things like public television networks, as well as old archival films. We digitize old materials, and people also with sort of internet generation films, but hundreds of thousands of them. We have over 800,000 audio recordings. We've got a great collection of bootleg concert recordings, but everybody's happy about it. So this is actually the bands that like to have tape sharing as long as nobody's making any money. It's a tradition started by the Grateful Dead. Oh, and we have everything the Grateful Dead ever did. So just go to archive.org. You can download it and play it, and as long as you don't sell it, everybody's happy. But also a lot of other types of audio recordings and news broadcasts and the like. We're kind of a hosting for the open world, such as Democracy Now! And those that do like to share. We're also archiving television. For the last 10 years, we've archived 10 channels of television, 24 hours a day at DVD quality. Russian, Chinese, Japanese, Iraqi, Al Jazeera, BBC, CNN, ABC, ABC, Fox. And we're archiving it, though we haven't made very much of that available, but I'll hit a little bit of a recent announcement soon. But the idea that you can go and think about doing everything, even 24 hours a day, channel years, channel decades of television is within our grasp. We just hit a milestone this last weekend. We now have over 3 million books and other texts available on the internet for free. So we think this is a huge milestone towards bringing the library to anybody. Most of these are out of copyright works that have been digitized by the Internet Archive staff in all these places. We have a room in the Library of Congress. We've got rooms in 27 libraries. And people are turning pages, photographing them, making them searchable, making them available for free. So it's 3 million books. There's an added program to this to make these to make more modern books available that have rights issues to them. So the way that we've done that is we've made over 100,000 books that are modern books, all the way through Harry Potter. Digitized those and reformatted them for the blind and dyslexic. When we made all of our books available to that community, it multiplied the collection that's available to them by about a factor of 5 to a factor of 10. More books are now available. And a lot of the partners we're using basically go and bring books to their scanning centers. We digitize them, and that's available for free. Beyond that, though, we've now made them available for lending. So for the 20th century books, so the books that are basically out of print, make them available one person at a time using the same protections that the publishers are using for their own in-print books. So the idea is a patron can come to openlibrary.org and check out a book and have it for 2 weeks. And at the end of that time, it kind of disappears, and somebody else can have that book. And it's available for free. And we're working now with states and libraries in general, but now really growing at sort of the state librarian level, where we're turning on whole states. So the California, Kansas, and North Carolina have basically agreed that all of the people within their state will have access through their libraries to 100,000 free electronic books to be able to bring this to people in a way that makes sort of everybody happy all the way around. We're probably best known, though, for archiving the World Wide Web. So we've been taking a snapshot of every website and trying to get every web page from every website every 2 months since 1996. It started only about, I don't know, I guess Alta Vista at that time was about 30 million pages, but it's now billions and billions. We have 150 billion web pages up on the Internet Archive for free, and it's put as part of the Wayback Machine, so you can look at web pages as they used to be. So it's starting to be a very large collection. All of our collections are probably about 6 petabytes of data. It goes mega, giga, tera, and the next is peta. I mentioned television. We just redid a collection that we'd put online before, around understanding September 11th, and basically made 3,000 hours available from before the first plane went in through September 17th, 24 hours a day, all of the news from around the world. So there was some station saying that Palestinians were dancing in the streets. Were they? Well, let's look at Palestinian television, and you can find out whether, you know, how the reaction was there, and it was nothing like that. So I think we now understand that television comes with a point of view, And if we're going to think critically, the way that we're all taught in high school, you need to be able to compare and contrast and quote. And television is very difficult to do that. So we're recording this to make a tool that allows people to be able to understand the world around them as portrayed by a very important medium that until now hasn't been a medium of record. And so we're trying to change that and add it to the library. So if you go to archive.org/911, you can see this cool interface where you can browse and see sort of all of this video over that whole week. So that's sort of an idea of mostly what we do. But I'm not here to talk about that. What I'm here to talk about is community broadband. We started in 1997 working on community broadband and community wireless because we were worried that there were going to become a few entrenched players that were going to make it difficult for those that want to make rich media available to the public in the public sphere. And it may not have happened quite yet, or you may say it's already happened, but there are chokeholds if there are too few players. So the idea of building a network that's open, that is high speed, and where people actually own the network themselves, where they're actually putting together their network hops, we thought would be a robust and resilient approach. So we've done this in a few generations over time, and we evolved sort of an idea of at least the backbone should be fast and free. If you hook on and do added value services, terrific, you can charge for it. But the idea of the backbone and the underlying infrastructure should be fast and free. Towards that, there's lots of things that have been improving. So we started out doing this before there was Wi-Fi, and there was just this proprietary stuff, and it was really designed for inside facilities. But tried putting it on roofs, on mountaintops, and the like to try to see, does this work? And it worked pretty well. It worked pretty well until lots of people jumped on board and started having all sorts of other Wi-Fi stuff out there, and the noise floor went out, and it got kind of drowned out. But the technology has been getting better, and what I'm really pleased about is that there's new technology now, we've got some of it here, that actually looks like it's worth going and doing a full-on court press. And I'll say sort of what it is we've been doing so far to see sort of how it's worked. So the improvements are going along great, but there are things that are declining, like the U.S. position in the world, just in general, but also on internet. This is unforgivable. This really doesn't make any sense. And I feel like I'm talking to the right guys to be able to try to make a difference here. So if we're going to have really high-speed gigabit applications, let's go and build networks ahead of where the commercial deployments, and there are little charts about, oh, nobody really wants another one of those. It's like, yes, they do. They just don't know they do. So if we're going to go and build out gigabit networks, it's going to be up to people like us. So there's good news and bad news here. So how about taking a real run at a citywide community broadband system? We've built out one combination and cooperation with San Francisco that actually is working quite well. It's a public-public partnership. So it's a not-for-profits working with public entities. And we find that we can fill in a lot of the holes that they find difficult to do, like going and spending $200 without going through an RFP process. There are things that we can go and do to go and move a lot faster, and in combination, we're basically gold congruent. We're trying to get broad public access to the internet, and we can do things that they can't, and it's working out quite well. Right now, there's over 7,000 households in the public housing that now have gigabit networks. I'm completely jealous. I have a lot of money, yet I have nothing like what the public housing residents have in terms of high-speed access to the internet. They've got 20 times faster than I have at my house, and I pay the most I can to Comcast. And it's free for them. So I think there's a bit of social justice to this. So 7,000 households. There's wired and there's also wireless to try to get to those households. We're now starting to put more and more antennas on the roof to be able to offer this to anybody through this hopping network, which I'm going to describe. But that the idea is to start with what San Francisco had a mandate to do with their housing. We want to serve everyone in San Francisco because it just doesn't cost very much. There's municipal fiber. We're using 5.8 gigahertz as a backbone, 2.4 as the end user access. There are 400 radios. And the last hop is crowdsourced. This is an interesting model. We went and put these things up back in about 2000, 2002, and people expected to be able to get on the internet from their couch in their house. And it wasn't going to happen. And so what we found is make it so that we put up enough of a backbone so that people can put an antenna on their roof, about as hard as putting up an old TV antenna, for those of us old enough to remember that, to go and get the internet to their house. So the last link is crowdsourced, and that makes it so that the deployment costs are very, very low. So the bottom things, I think, are the important parts. The city basically deployed this, I understand, hand wave, for less than $40 per household. The cost of the Internet Archive for this is down in the noise. We can't even account for it. It's so low. And why is this? Because there's a good partnership, but also we're only making the backbone. But the backbone enables things that weren't possible before. Some of the radios, just to sort of chart out some of the radios that are spread around San Francisco, they're on this municipal Wi-Fi, municipal fiber, but also some of it's by one hop or so to be able to go and go to these buildings. And whenever we go to a building, we share it from there. So, Ralph, would you mind holding up what's typical of the equipment that we're currently using? The hat is just for size comparison. So it basically you receive through your dish to talk to the next level up, and then you bring a wire down into the building, so it lights up the building at, we find, 40 megabits per second bidirectional. Works quite well. And then it shares, we share it back out through a wireless port to anybody that can see it. So you use it, and you're building it at the same time. It's kind of like the old Usenet or BitNet technologies, where by being joining the network, you're building the network. And this is actually working quite well. So there's 400 nodes that are run by the city, and it didn't cost very much to get there. The overall architecture is something like this. There's the internet, and what's in blue is provided by our nonprofit. What's in red is provided by the city, and what's in green is other people, anybody. So we have linked their fiber onto the broadband internet based on our network so that they're on at a gigabit. We'd go faster if they had more wavelengths for it. And then it basically travels around the city and goes on to high buildings to go and antennas that we provide that offer it to anybody that can see it. Then people from their roofs hook into it and drop it down into their buildings. It's very inexpensive and very quick to deploy. So what we're looking for and what I'd love out of this and have hopefully enough time for a little bit of a discussion is this. This is my real final slide. Is what we're interested in is finding the next two cities that would be interested in moving forward with this. What the Internet Archive provides is bandwidth, equipment, and installation of the first five sites and training to go and make it so that a city or a community can go and build out onto others. The idea of 50 rooftops might be what is required to go and spread this sort of thing out. Think of firehouses. Think of libraries, which is what we're using a lot of in San Francisco, to be able to spread it out. We need access to either some radio towers to be a sort of a star network or a fiber, if you happen to have it. Anything to be able to move around at a sort of secure level to get the backbone so that it's very stable. The backhaul, we're looking for a university or a community college that can help us backhaul. We're basically backhauled through a switching point, but a lot of cities don't have good switching points. So going and coming back over an educational network, we're on all of them, to be able to drop to the Internet Archive so that we would offer the internet access, the IP addresses, from our space. So all the hate mail from the copyright cartel would come to us, and we would sort of manage the network if you will, from there, but at a very low-key level. But we've found over the last year and a half that that's all that's required. So basically no money changes hands in this. We're not looking forward to large lawyerly agreements. We don't have any lawyers on staff and don't want to change that. So the idea is to find groups that want to do this. And what we're really looking for is people with light in their eyes that says, yes, I can get you over the inevitable hurdles that come with a deployment like this. But it's a partnership, real honest to God partnership, between a public entity and a nonprofit, in some sense, public entity as well. So fast and free, and can we help? Thank you very much. What's the security issues? It's just the internet. So if you really want to secure it, use HTTPS. But we're much like an ISP. It's just like Comcast, AT&T, you know. So I don't know. I'm sorry. I don't know how to answer that any better. It's just the internet.
What I'm thinking more about is that our IT department is always worried about people hacking into our systems. Which, of course, again, like you just said, you can't prevent that. But you know, firewalls in place, so on and so forth. What types of safeguards are in this? Or because it is true
this,
community.
This is meant for broad public access to the internet. So if you tap off of this and put your network on it, then put a firewall up. So, you know, if you're going to put one of these things on your roof, you're going to bring down a wire, and that's just like you're tapping into an ISP. Then go and protect things however you want to with any of firewalls or VPNs or however you want to deal with it. We do no snooping. We don't do any of that stuff. We don't go and put ads in front of people. We just don't believe in that. It just doesn't make any sense. So the idea is to go and get at least a gigabit to people so that they have it to be bidirectional and open.
Oh. How long have you been doing this in San Francisco? I missed that.
We've been building these things out since 1997 in San Francisco, but it's gone through a couple waves. So there was sort of the 1997 era. There's sort of 2003, 2002 era, and now this next wave is sort of 2009 to 2011 is when this real deployment has been live and running based on this newer gear. And the newer gear really is much better than building our own Linux boxes and putting them on roofs.
You said you had you're looking for two additional cities.
Yes.
I'm sure you're not looking for cities of 100. What size? And,
we're looking for people with a light in their eye. I mean, just the people that say, we work with hundreds of libraries around the world, national libraries, and we worked with lots of different organizations in different ways. And the things that I've found to be the most successful, the best way to find out whether something is going to go, is if it's the person that's looking across at you and said, I've got to make this work. This is really important to me.
Okay.
And if that happens, then... that's the key part of success for us.
So it's not a critical mass that you need for this?
No, it's not critical mass. We'd like to basically do something that's useful. We'd like to do something that's actively copied. There's nothing proprietary about what it is we're trying to do. We're just trying to make it so that the internet works, expands, grows, and at gigabit levels in ways that aren't controlled by a few incumbents.
Thanks.
When giving away the service for basically free, what model of support do you have in place? Like, what resources can you give to end users that are tapping into that free network?
Very little. Services do the Internet Archive provide? Very little. Fortunately, it's required very little so far. There was this whole sort of question about 24-hour helplines and ba-da-da-da-da. It's like, at least so far, it's not been needed. At least out of us. Now, the city of San Francisco has gone and put these sorts of things up, but I think in many ways their support issues or sort of this, you know, the security or the pornography or the whatever, they can just go and say, look, it's the Internet Archive. So, you know, point at us. So there's sort of, I think from their perspective, they can go and and offload some of that support or support expectation to us. And we found that it's just not that hard to just encompass it into what it is the Internet Archive is doing. I asked Ralph Mullen, wave your hand, is the engineer that's leading this project, just sort of how much time has it all taken? And it looks like it's less than one-tenth of one person. Now, it's not any old person, but one-tenth of a stunning engineer over the course of the last year to get our aspects of this built up and going. And San Francisco is here. They can sort of tell you a little bit of what it took in terms of bucket trucks and stuff like that to get their housing plans rolled out. But what we're looking for in most of this is actually not so much doing all the housing and making sure everybody in a housing block does this, is try to at least put the backbone on top of a city such that people can draw it down and use it in new and different ways within their own worlds.
Craig Wilson, Arden Hills. I realize you're looking for the people with the gleam and the light in their eye, but I'm wondering from a topographical standpoint if there's an environment that's going to be better, such as buildings, a larger city, or say suburban with lots of trees. Is that going to be a problem with multipathing and that sort of thing?
As little as we can do over wireless, the better. If there's a fiber that's running around, that helps ever so much. High locations. Harvey Branscombe, who set up one of these first networks with Sun, Bill Joy, in Aspen, he said, make sure you've got really good high locations. So good, clear line of sight so that you can basically get to people's houses or apartment buildings with clear line of sight. So fortunately, cities often control some of these nice high locations, like radio towers. So radio towers are good. Fiber rings are extremely helpful. And then another is some way to get back to the Internet, say over an educational network like Internet 2, Lambda Rail, whatever. So it might be in a community college or a university to be able to go and tunnel back to the Internet Archive. What we're allergic to is monthly fees. We don't have any funding for that. We can get funding for the initial deployment, the training, but we can't fund on an ongoing basis. So that's sort of a key point for sort of what we're looking for out of this phase.
It looks to me like economically it works because the backbone is sort of piggybacked on the city's fiber, or it's a mesh carried on by each individual installation, and the end users put in their own endpoints or drops, so that's not a cost. The only other piece seems to be the connection to the Internet backbone at the end. Where does that come from? Or what does that cost?
The Internet Archive has a 10 gigabit connection to the Internet, and with all of the use in San Francisco, we can't even make it. If you were to graph it and zoom in, you just can't see it. So it's down in the noise. There's just no cost to it when it comes right down to it. So, and it's amazing, but it's true that at least at this point, the actual bandwidth costs are such, even in a small nonprofit like us, we can't even notice it. I think the best way to contact us on this project is ralph@archive.org. That's Ralph. You can talk to him afterwards, and we're just trying to find, does this work? It may be that you say, oh, we're already doing this already. All right, it's all been done. That would be great. But the idea is we'd like to try to get this out there, and Ralph has been sort of point of contact at the Internet Archive. I'm Brewster@archive.org, and we'd like very much to see if this works.
Thanks. I just wanted to understand on the bandwidth side, just to put in context what that bandwidth offer means, that you're offering access to the commodity internet bandwidth you have, that some portion of it, right?
Yes.
I think you said a gigabit.
Yes.
And just so my colleagues here understand, because some of us are in the business of buying internet bandwidth and lots of us aren't, because our IT people may be doing it, but in the biggest cities, you could be in a really competitive market paying $5 or $7 or $10 a megabit. And in smaller communities, you could be paying 30 times that much, 40 times that much. So the offer of a gigabit of bandwidth to the internet is an extraordinarily generous offer, depending on where you're located and if you can hook in and access it. But that's the quantifying that is it's a lot of dollars. So
thank you.
Did I get that right? Did I explain?
Yes, we're currently spending, I think the last negotiation is $2 and some odd per megabit per month. And so our bandwidth bill is you know, but then there's other services on top of it. But there's, but you're basically basically right. And so, but if it's shared across a very large number of people, it just doesn't come to that much. So it is a big number in some ways, but on the other hand, let's go light up whole cities and not worry about it. Let's not spend our time and effort going and putting bandwidth limits, whatever. Just let it on. You know, let them go, and let's fix it if they're overusing it. That's the world that built the internet that we're using today. Let's see if we can get it up the next stage. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Not yet. There we go. Okay. So we're very fortunate to have on short notice Vili Wang here. She's the President and Chief Executive Officer of Baycat. And she, you know, you have the Brady Bunch on your computer here. It's not showing up on there yet, but.
Shh, don't give it away.
I was going to just stop talking and watch the show.
Go for it.
Okay. Vili brings an extensive and pretty unique 20-plus year background in education, media, arts and technology programming, and nonprofit business and law. Baycat sprung from her passion of using digital media arts to capture stories untold and to create social change. Baycat is a 501c3 nonprofit social enterprise. It educates, empowers, and employs young people from historically underserved communities in digital media arts. It inspires high school students and young adults to stay in school, become lifelong learners, and it empowers them to use the power of digital media to design to transform their communities. Baycat employs program graduates to produce professional work with international and local impact for clients such as Yahoo, Bank of the West, Union Bank, Citibank, San Francisco Foundation, the Japan Society, the Golden Gate National Park Conservancy, the U.S. Department of the Interior, and others. Prior to Baycat, Vili was a teacher in the San Francisco Unified School District for 3 years, specializing in project-based collaborative teaching methodologies that incorporates music, media, and arts in standards-based curricula, which is something that is very interesting to me because in one of my other lives, you know, it's always easy to come up with standards and testing for subjects like math and English or foreign languages, but measuring one's growth in a year of choir is quite a different activity. So I'd love to talk with you offline about that if you don't get to it in your presentation. So without further ado, Vili Wang.
Thank you. Thanks, Tim.
Okay, call me the pinch hitter of the afternoon. I know you guys did not sign up for me, but you are now stuck with me. Are you ready? I have met Brewster and Ralph, and it's really great to hear about the progress of your work. And I think this is actually a great precursor to what I'm going to present. Because at the end of the day, I was also on a panel with Craig Newmark, who I understand was here this morning, and somebody from Intel, and they were saying, you know, digital divide's over, everybody's got a mobile phone. Broadband, hardwiring people in the projects. Most of the young people that we serve and the families we serve, they're in the projects. So how come they're not using this service? Do we solve the problems alone with just mobile phones? And I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir here. Are we preaching to the choir here? So I am going to walk you through a little process and story and also what we do at BayCat as maybe, hopefully, an instigator of ideas for you to think about to how to make this relevant to the community and to the end users. Because at the end of the day, we could have all the technology we want, but if people aren't using it to further better their lives and better our communities, then we're not doing our jobs, right? So, and you gave it away, Ken. Let's watch a little TV, yeah? Story. Come on, you guys know it, right? Come on. Yes, this group must somehow form a family. The Brady Bunch. Yeah, uh-huh. Okay, if y'all not awake and not looking at your iPad 2s, then you pass. Well, I don't know about you, but this definitely did not look like my family when I was growing up. Yeah, and I saw this on reruns. I'm not that old, right? Perception. Perception is everything, as we know. And as a kid growing up watching TV, as Brewster said, that's one of those mediums that has been part of our lives, even though how many people are watching internet on TV now as opposed to internet TV? TV on internet, yes? But it still forms perceptions every single day for each one of us. And I think what's interesting is what is said and unsaid? You know, back in the day when the Brady Bunch was around, you didn't really know why the single father with three kids and single mom with three daughters somehow got together. It's not like reality shows and Jerry Springer these days where they're talking about the drama, right? Somehow I knew my family was really different. Here's the Wong Bunch. Because somehow their problems got solved in 30 minutes. Does that happen in your family? Plus, they didn't look like me. All the other Chinese people I saw on TV were doing kung fu or serving up food. And, you know, my mom is an immigrant mom, and really, BayCat, I started BayCat because I'm inspired by her story. It is her story that I really want to tell. And the men in my life, my dad, whose lap I'm sitting on, and my brother, they actually became the bane of my existence. And we don't know each other well enough yet, so I'm going to keep those things unsaid. You know what I'm talking about? But perception, BayCat's mission and vision starts with bringing relevancy to every single person that we touch. And that means it's donor to the students we serve. Your story matters. And the question becomes, how does your story really get integrated into everybody else's? And how does your own perception of yourself and your story matter? How does it influence the way you behave? Well, we think about that from all aspects. Perception, positive perception, becomes empowerment. And we all want our communities to transform. So, as Brewster said, much of media still accentuates and stereotypes the negative. How do we keep it positive? Well, now the power of making media has become much more accessible. And if we do give that to the young people and to people, as we all know, YouTube, how many people spend at least an hour watching YouTube? Come on, raise your hands. Oh, yeah, don't be shy. I know you watching the little puppies and all that stuff. But think about it. Media still is there to transform, and how much of that is positive? September 11th. It's so funny that you brought that up as well. So my idea of making it, let me give you a little perception story, was I grew up in the projects in New York with my mom and worked the sweatshops. And one day I thought, I'm going to make it. My kitchen window was framed the World Trade Center. And I said, you know, I'm going to get there one day. I'm going to get to Wall Street And when I do, my mom's not going to have to work so hard. And one day I did, and I got all jazzed up in my business suit. I used to love photography. I still do. And I took my camera during lunch hour, and I just laid between the two buildings. Yes, in my business suit during lunch hour. And I took these pictures, and actually I just gave a presentation in Korea, and it just so happens, I'm like, what am I going to say to these people in Korea whose language I don't even know about our model? And, you know, I thought, this is something, I found these pictures 2 days before I left. And here we are, September, right? A decade later. So my idea, my perception was that these were the best offices in New York. It was the financial capital of the world, and these were architectural wonders. And as you know, sometime before September 11th, somebody also saw these buildings, and they saw planes going through them. You could give me all the money in the world. You could give me all the diamonds. You could give me all the wealth and all the riches, and I could never imagine that. Never. Perception is so important that these people acted on it, just like I did. All I did was take a camera and lie between the two buildings, and yes, maybe I inconvenienced a few people who had to walk by me. But these people also acted on this, and they saw, their perception was that this could be a target. This could create chaos. And they acted on it, and it changed the world. Everyone who has been alive and remembers September 11th, not only did it change the world, it changed your world. You each have a story about September 11th. And that is the power of perception. And as lighthearted as we could be watching puppy videos on YouTube, we can't forget the impact of this kind of perception. So I ask you, we need good people in decision-making places in every aspect. And what you do is so important in creating access. So the question becomes, what perception do you choose to act on when you make those decisions? And for us, one of the main criteria that we look at is the cycle of poverty and how it affects education and economy. And I know I'm preaching to the choir. So quickly, 37.5 million disconnected youth, that's 16 to 24-year-olds who are not working or not in school. Most of them are young people of color, especially Latino or African-American families. Not everybody's here in California, so I won't be commiserating about the fact that we're in the bottom 50. At the end of the day, we know when these kids drop out, their median earnings, $19,000 a year. This affects every single person in the room, and it affects our nation. So when we think about the perception, no longer our model does not just think about changing the perception of who we serve. It is not just about convincing the youth and their families. It is about convincing all the stakeholders. A nonprofit, social enterprise, I deliberately set it up that way only because people will pay attention to us both in the public and private sectors, who we serve and who serves them. Every single person on that page needs to have a change in perception for this to work. So that is not the only task. We also have to change perception in all these content areas. It's not just about technology. Technology becomes the tool to solve public health issues, workforce development issues, violence prevention, environmental and food justice, community development, arts education. You know, these are not separate buckets, as we know. And I think one of the biggest challenges becomes, how do we actually integrate this? How does content and process come together? Well, believe it or not, we try to answer this every single day in what we do. Do you guys believe me? Let me show you the Brady Bunch again. Remember that? Well, I have reinvented the family. We have reinvented the family. Here's the new Brady Bunch. Yay! This is my family. These are my children. Yes, I'll introduce you to a few of them as time permits. The important thing as I go through these stories that I want you to understand is I happen to be standing up here, but this is a portfolio of work that has taken a gigantic team of people to make happen. And when I talk about this, it is stakeholders on that prior page that believed in us to either hire us, fund us, work together with us, volunteer with us, in addition to the talent on this page. So please remember that as I show you this. So it starts with our very first kid. He's our poster child. He's the co-host of Zoom In. They call a TV show. We are now up to 22 episodes. And It's crazy. Let me just show it to you, and you'll get a sense. Yes, we stole that. Relevance. That last Google map was a billboard campaign that we got to work with 40 young people with Dr. Joe Marshall's program, one of the oldest programs here in San Francisco, working with young people who are at risk of either having been in jail or about to go to jail. The power of having young people advertise to young people, it's not from the outside in. We are community media producer, empowering young people to tell their own message. A little 30-second PSA by Mission High School students about eating healthy. How much more power does that bring? How much more relevance? Why is this important? Well, will they tune in at home to share on Facebook the video that they just worked on? They do. Do they exchange beats and rhymes on Facebook because they're trying to create music on the side, even at home? They do. You have to make it relevant to them. So educate, empower, employ, entertain. Let's not be ashamed about having our young people have their talents be seen. Here's Nick. Remember him? Zoom in. We saw him when he was 11. Yes, I'm now old enough to watch him go and graduate from high school. This was his high school graduation picture. He is definitely one of those Latino kids, didn't know what to do with themselves. His parents love him. Let's change perception of parents also in these neighborhoods. They work hard. Yeah, they may not show up at PTA meetings because they're working three jobs, right? But they supported Nick every step of the way. And our parents do. So we make a very deliberate effort. When our kids produce the TV show, we make sure the first person that sees it, we do a giant premiere, 150 people showing up, and their kids show off their work first to their parents and friends. Because, you know, 24/7, they are surrounded by people who still need to believe in them. And I don't care if it's a foster guardian, It's their best friend. It's their parent. They're the ones who have to believe, and they are part of that stakeholder group. And here he is. He is now, he just graduated. I mean, he just finished his freshman year at Columbia College studying film. I said, you better not forget me when you get to the Oscars. And he came back in San Francisco. Guess what? We hired him as a TA. It's coming full circle. He's teaching the next generation of young people, and it's pretty thrilling to see. Here's another young person, DeMarie.
I would not imagine speaking right here today. I have grown since the first day of baby. Now I am more social and more academic than I was. BayCast has influenced me to do better things in my life. Without BayCast, I think I wouldn't be in the position I am in today. I would not be in school of arts or not be influenced to make movies anymore. Making this movie proves that I am over my father's death. This movie means a lot more to my family and to his legacy. So this is me saying goodbye to him. And I thank David for sharing his story with the world.
We can't forget that art and the making of art is just as important, and it heals our young people and our communities. So what do you think it felt like for his mom to see this, and his grandma, and then to find out that DeMarie was asked to submit this piece to Worldwide Film Festival? He actually predicted his future in that little snippet. He didn't know. I showed this to every single person coming through BayCat, and there happened to be somebody who was getting submissions for Worldwide Film Festival. Right? Art healed. And do they see it in school? Do they get the chance to make mistakes and tell very personal stories? This took a safe environment, people that he cared about, to be able to tell this story in this way. By the way, he didn't get final placement at the World Film Festival, but he did get first prize for Best Documentary Short on KCSM last year. Here he is, hungry college student. I fed him 3 entrees that day in 1 hour. So this is not the end of the story, though. He also got to Columbia College in Hollywood. He also got to School of the Arts. Why? Because he had a portfolio that was built at BayCat. When I went to go visit him, I could see the sadness in his eyes. He didn't have the spark anymore. Why? Because he was lonely. His support system was not there. This summer, he moved back. Am I saddened? You know what? This is his story, his journey of success. And we can't forget that many of the metrics right now about our young people are, let's get them through high school. That's not enough. How do we get a DeMarie, now that we've waived this carrot of, you know, you can be empowered as a filmmaker, how do we continue to support him? And at the end of the day, you know, I attribute it to, yeah, it could be Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead or whomever. You know, you're a rock star because you have the right tools around you. People become great guitar players because, you know, sometimes 2 o'clock in the morning you can't go to sleep and you got this riff and you grab your guitar and you play it. DeMarie is in competition with people who have access all the time. He doesn't have a system at home that's like what he has to use at BayCat. So as much as the hardwiring might be there, we can't forget that the tools and the portfolio of tools that one needs is much greater. And I know this is a hard one to solve, and we keep trying to find the partnerships to make that work. I'm going to skip that. But so just to give you an idea, these 3 young people were some of the first people that started. Ms. Casper, who's in the middle, and by the way, that's my mom. So she didn't know that she was going to have this beautiful African-American granddaughter, basically. But Casper's like my child. I actually have taken her to Japan, because one of our clients is the Japan Society. So she got to be production assistant and ran camera for 2 weeks in Japan. Yes, kid from the hood in Japan who's allergic to fish. Woo! So we do tell them, back to the perception, why school? Going back to relevance, why does this all matter? Because, you know, there are careers in media. But can we stop patting them on the back and saying, well, you're an artist, that's great, go get a job. No, we got to build a path. We're right in the middle of that. If any of you in other cities have great examples of that, of building that pathway. We are right in the middle of figuring that out and actually documenting the success cases we have. Here's another story, Isaac. He's 20 years old, and here's a little bit of his film.
I just accepted it. I see something like crooked, I fix it on the same stuff over and over again. Oh yeah, when I look at people, I look at people for a certain, for a short period of time, then I look down, or I look away.
How many know somebody with a mental challenge or learning challenge? So both Damari and Isaac have that, and Isaac was rejected by every single program that had to do with media, and he's an avid photographer. And here's his mom watching him as he showcased his piece. He's in three film festivals, San Francisco, Chicago, and New York, and we're about to go to New York, back to my hood, together. And he got paid for this one. He's a young man with Asperger's, once upon a time would not even look at me, would not let anybody touch him, and now he's at Fresno State at a special program where he could get included into going to post-secondary education. If we don't allow our young people who are especially at those margins that we ignore to succeed, and if we don't tell Isaac's story, then we don't give people hope or that positive perception that change can happen. So as I show you these, please go to our website and get back in contact with me. But one thing that you can do is share these stories. Believe it or not, Isaac is now a spokesperson for young people or people with mental challenges. He has gotten up in front of hundreds of people like this, speaking as an advocate. Crazy, right? And now that he's getting paid, wow. I can't even talk to him. I gotta make an appointment to go see him. So we're in 10 film festivals. Wow. As far as India and Italy, your story matters, their story matters. These stories are based on real people. They're narratives, some of them are narratives. And you saw Isaac's piece, that was flip camera work. It doesn't have to be professionally made. Do we have professionally made pieces? Absolutely. But now there's a gamut, there's a continuum, right? And all this, again, how do you get as many eyeballs streamed through broadband on this? We can do it. Here's another one, quickie.
This is my time now. Trying to be proud, gotta put my swag up. Let all the pain out, let the joy in. Gotta be ready, cause this is my moment. My moment had to be the first time we did a music video. That really pushed all of us to want to go to that next level. Really gave everybody a lot of inspiration. Don't just try to just do it just because you feel like you have to. Do it because you know that you want to. It's something that you want to do. Turn my moment into our movement.
Cool, right? People hire our young people. Yes, that's Mark, black man, hoodie, baggy jeans. People you're supposed to be scared of, right? I didn't show you this picture first, deliberately. How does your perception change now that I show you this picture? Same young man. How does your perception change? Same young man. He's a songwriter. He's a role model. And by the way, I wake up to his ringtone every day. You could buy it on iTunes. It's very catchy. There's a future there. There's something there, and we've got to connect the dots for these young people. So he sees himself differently. Is he a pain in the butt right now, and do I not look at his Facebook page? Absolutely. The answer is not simple, but we know he was empowered for that moment. He was empowered enough. So not only that message that he did with My Moment, we can also show it to other people. And not only that, people hire us to do this professionally. So we make money. We love that. That's why we're a social enterprise. You're going to see these out there, right? And it's all about, guess what? A teenager designed this AGOC logo. It's on a building. It's in one of the housing developments that the broadband's in. It's designed by a teenager. This is a five-year report for the Rosenberg Foundation. Our young people like and want to make video gaming apps. We just did something with Android. How do we make it into a profession? How do we build that bridge? Y'all, any of you have the answer in here to help us do that? Please come to me after. I'm expecting you to be here. Ebony's Beauty Supply, guess what? We are part of that economic development bucket of work. So we actually get to contract with everybody from the Mayor's Office of Criminal Justice to the Department of Health to the Office of Economic Workforce Development to community development. The power of media in creating these content, stop feeling sorry for these kids and stop being scared of these kids. Hire us. It's possible, because we are professionals. And we're also entertainers. Credits roll, you're always going to see more than one name, but the one I want you to remember is Tiffany Jones. She's the animator. And I love that she picked jazz. That's the other great thing they get exposed to. She has won first prize for best animated short in two festivals. We just got Pixar to join our board, and actually Eric Pearson, post-production manager, is going to be our chair by the beginning of next year. Google's on our board. LinkedIn just joined on our board. How do we connect the dots? And here is Tiffany winning her first prize, but she's also being introduced by Miss Bartz, who didn't last. Shall we talk about Yahoo? No, we won't go there. But anyway, Tiffany actually got to speak in front of worldwide Yahoo. 5,000 people, 7,000 people, however many, worldwide. This young lady is from Baby Hunters Point, two hardworking parents who invested to make sure that she had everything she needed at home. So that access now is relevant. And this young lady has a bright future ahead, and we're going to keep her nearby and want to continue to hire her. So as I wrap, let me just show you her. Social justice, critical thinking, media literacy. This was done after the Oscar Grant incident. It's still relevant as our young people watch the news every single day. And Teak, how gorgeous is she? She's like the next Angelina Jolie. She's a singer, she's a performer. Once again, perception, she was also homeless for 2 months this year. her mom was living out of her car, and she was able to hop around on a few friends' couches. She's been in the foster youth program. This is a young person who is in college, and she is trying to make it. And I don't know the answer to that yet. We are trying to support her every possible way that we can. And it's not just one kid. It is hundreds and thousands of kids in the same system. So as you think about solutions using technology, don't forget the context in which we need to make this relevant for them. And that's part of what we do. Jose is also a great story. He's the first to graduate from his family, and we have now hired him onto the permanent team of BayCat. So part of the reason, and it's not as if I didn't go to corporate America right away and say, look, hire our kids. They're like, well, who are you? And what skills do they have? As those credits rolled up before, it's about teaching those hard skills and the soft skills. They have to learn how to present, work as a team, receive criticism, give feedback. Those are hard things to teach, but we're able to prove that we're willing to hire young people, and they can do professional work, and they could get into film festivals, right? So these are just a couple of, and just look at the pictures of Bayview Hunters Point. Look how gorgeous this is. Poorest neighborhoods in San Francisco. Looks beautiful, shot professionally. And do you know what it felt like to have the red carpet, Oscar style, in the community with over 300 residents looking at their own neighborhood? They were screaming for joy, the pride in their eyes of seeing their own neighborhood. And they were like, man, you made Bayview look so good, right? Perception, that transformation starts with them believing that their neighborhood is worth investing in themselves and with others. These are just some of the other film festivals and building capacity for other organizations. So which perception will you choose to act on? And this is why I do this every day. Maisha's of the world. That was 2008. We've lost track of her. I hope she's okay. That means she's 15, 16. We shouldn't have 15 and 16-year-olds, 13-year-olds asking if they are going to be alive. They'd like to go to college. Point Richmond, Richmond. How many cities do we have where wealth and poverty live side by side? And access, mobile phones, apps are designed for people with wealth. And yes, our young people, as I said to Craig Newmark at the panel, you could give us 1,000 phones, but they're not going to be banking online. They're not going to be looking for jobs online because they're still wondering if they're going to be alive. And this moment in time, you know, I'm a New Yorker who got to take this picture lying between the buildings. I didn't realize it was a fleeting moment. And as much as I would love to take our young people and even you there with me today, it's no longer there. But I do believe if we really think together and understand the context and understand our own perceptions, and we're very honest about what they are and put them within the layers of these contexts, that we could create solutions that will be very powerful. And hopefully that will change the world as well. So thank you for listening, and I'd be happy to answer your questions. Did I do okay as a pinch hitter?
Oh,
you. I was like, what?
I do have a question. I'm Darren Zilke with Denver, Colorado, and I think Denver, were you two organizations partnered together as part of the creation of this?
No.
Okay, that's fine. Sorry. What I'm wondering is more about, if you could speak more about your operating methodology there, because a lot of us are used to sort of the older model of cities or cable contributing there, and that's kind of the old world order of how are you addressing all of that when there may not be funding that is very vital, obviously, but is not really available anymore.
Totally. You know, if we use, thank you for that question. I always say if we use money as an excuse, we you know, how many times have we used that excuse? When we had a lot of money, we still use it as an excuse, right? So if you were to ask our current board chair, he'd probably say, you know, Billy is one of the craziest, like, financial whores in the world, right? I'll use that word not lightly. So we're a nonprofit social enterprise, and I really built the model to be a hybrid. Everything that I describe is not traditional. So if you really look at it, let's look at education from that business angle. And so maybe it was the ex-banker lawyer in me, right? But we have to be able to speak to both sides of the equation. So we actually earn through Studio Baycat, we earn 25 to 40% of our revenue. As a nonprofit, we get the best of both worlds. We also get to apply for government grants, corporations, individuals. We get to run that individual campaign, and we have foundations. This would not have happened without meeting the right people who introduced us and me to the right people at the right time, who had the appetite and who were willing to invest. Now, in 2008, when the bottom dropped and everybody decided to withdraw at the same time, I went to, when you think about the avenues where you could go to create the financial model, where is the lowest hanging fruit? And at that point, although everybody had lost their shirt, I really thought about who are our major investors. You know who the major investors are? Individuals, our board members, the people who dedicated time, not just money, their energy to believing in this mission. So I went to them, and one of our founding board members happens to be Herbie Hancock. Yes, can we talk about Herbie? And I said, Herbie, if there's any time I need you, it's right now. We got to start a five-year campaign. Why? Because the bottom just dropped. Nobody's going to do any multi-year funding, and we're going to have to live with a $500,000 deficit. I got Big Head out of a $500,000 deficit because at that point, the rug just got pulled, right? So if you're thinking smartly about money and not always thinking there's never enough, what do you have and what can you do with it becomes the better questions to ask. And then asking where is it that you need to build your base of income? So whether it's designing a menu of services, and you know, now that we know we can do event captures and the Yahoos of the world have hired us 4 years in a row, even different departments, I've gone back to them and said, hey, you came in as a client? Well, I want you as a donor. Who do I talk to? So I've actually created new vocabulary. Our clients have become donors, and our donors, like Bank of the West, they got it right away. They gave us philanthropy dollars, but the woman who is managing corporate affairs, she got it. She's like, let me introduce you to marketing people. Because guess what? One of our other grantees, the YMCA, they need a logo. So from year one, they became a donor rent. They were donors and they were clients, right? It's not about not enough money. Did they not have enough money? Yes, but we were able to find two sources of income from one entity, right? Does that answer your question a little? Not easy, though. Not easy to do. Anyway, it's fun. Thank you so much.
Okay, just a few housekeeping items. Before we break, I wanted to again thank Comcast for sponsoring our lunch today.